Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hey, guys. This is going to be a health assessment and assessing the skin or the integumentary system. The auto-generated voices will sometimes read the text and they'll pick up on the programmer's syntax or the code that they use to build the program in the episode. So if you hear stuff like hashtag, tag, 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 or whatever they say, then that's what that is. Okay. Again, this is coming straight from the book that we are using in my program, and this is coming from the PowerPoints that the instructors are uploading to our learning system. But yeah, and again, these characters or these auto-generated hosts, sometimes they'll say things that are off or weird, like instead of HIPAA, they'll say HIPAA. Instead of clotting factor XA, they'll say factor XA, or they'll say like cranial nerve CNI or CNII or CNXI or whatever, right? So just be on the lookout for that. But other than that, the content is still very, very good. And it's very, very spot on, again, because it's only pulling from sources from like the book and whatnot. So again, I hope you guys enjoy the integumentary system. Oh, boy, got some blood going.
Yeah,
it's
with blood.
He's wearing it, too. Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appearance that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in. The top of the vehicle was caved in, so she was hanging out parked in the window.
She's 45 minutes of CPR, no return of circulation. We can stop CPR. 6-0-3.
Okay, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're tackling a really big one, literally. The largest organ system in the body, the integumentary system. We're talking skin, hair, nails, the whole package.
We are. And it's often, you know, kind of overlooked, but it's so visible. And we're not just scratching the surface today, if you'll pardon the pun.
Oh, nice one.
This is really meant to be that comprehensive reference guide for you, the learner, because the skin, it's this amazing window, right? It can show signs of trouble, maybe impaired circulation, endocrine issues, sometimes long before other symptoms pop up.
Exactly. So our mission here is to go deeper than just basic anatomy. We're pulling out all that high-yield info from the sources, the stuff you absolutely need to know for assessment, the pathophysiology behind conditions, and those clinical pearls that really help with understanding and remembering it all.
Mm-hmm. We've got materials covering the structure, how to take a good history, what to look for in the physical exam, and then digging into major conditions like skin cancer, MRSA, and those dreaded pressure injuries.
Right. But before we get to the problems, we need that foundation. You mentioned the skin has, what, 8 core functions? That's quite a job description.
It really is. Think about it. Physical barrier, temperature control, managing fluids and electrolytes, absorption, excretion, sensation, immunity, even vitamin D synthesis. It's doing a lot.
Mm.
And it manages all that with just 3 main layers.
Okay, let's break those down then. Layer 1, the top coat, the epidermis. What's the key thing we need to grasp about it beyond just being the surface?
Well, the key is its dynamic nature. It's mostly made of keratin-forming cells, sure, but the really crucial part is that it completely turns over, replaces itself every 3 to 4 weeks.
Wow, constantly rebuilding.
Constantly. That's why superficial scrapes heal relatively quickly. And of course, it's where we find melanin, giving us our skin color and that initial shield against UV rays.
Got it. Then dive a bit deeper and we hit the dermis. You called it the structural engine earlier.
That's a good way to put it. The dermis is, well, relatively thin, but it's packed with collagen fibers. It's strong, elastic, resilient. That's the support layer.
And clinically, That elasticity is key, right?
Absolutely critical. It's what lets the skin resist tearing from bumps or shear forces. And, you know, when that collagen breaks down with age, that resistance just plummets. That's why older adults are so susceptible to skin tears.
Makes perfect sense. Connects the anatomy straight to the clinical picture.
Right. And the dermis is also highly vascular, lots of blood vessels for temperature regulation. Plus, this is the layer where everything else originates. Nerves, the oil glands, sweat glands, hair follicles. It all starts here.
Okay. And anchoring it all down below is the subcutaneous tissue.
Yep, the deeper layer. It's mostly loose connective tissue and fat. And it has two really vital roles. First, fat storage. It's an energy reserve.
Right.
Second, and very relevant clinically, that fat acts as insulation, conserving body heat. It also provides crucial cushioning, protecting the muscles and bones underneath, especially over those bony spots prone to pressure.
Okay, structure covered. Now, what about the things that grow out of the skin? The appendages. Let's start with hair. The sources mentioned two types.
That's right. You've got vellus hair. That's the very short, pale, fine stuff, sometimes called peach fuzz, that covers most of the body, provides a little insulation.
And the other type?
That's terminal hair. It's longer, darker, coarser. We see it initially on the scalp and eyebrows. Then puberty kicks in, and you get terminal hair growth in the armpits, the perineal area, and, of course, the face and chest in males.
Okay. Moving over to nails. We know they're hard plates of keratinized cells. You pointed out that the nail bed actually goes beyond the fingertip bone. Why is that detail important?
That little extension is surprisingly important for function. It gives rigidity to the fingertip pulp, which significantly boosts our tactile precision. Think about picking up something tiny, like a pin. You need that firm backstop.
Huh. Never thought about it that way. Damage the nail? You could affect fine motor skills.
Precisely. And then we have the glands. Let's talk oil first. Sebaceous glands.
Attached to hair follicles, right. Except palms and soles.
Exactly. They secrete sebum, that oily, lipid-rich substance, its main job. Waterproofing the skin and hair, keeping things flexible. And when sebum production decreases, like in older adults, you get that characteristic dry, cracking skin.
Which leads us to the sweat glands. Crucial for cooling. But there are two types, and they often get mixed up.
They do. You have Ehrens glands. These are everywhere, the most numerous type. Their main job is thermoregulation. They secrete sweat, which is mostly water and salt, directly onto the skin surface. Evaporation cools you down.
Simple enough. What about the other kind?
The apocrine glands.
Yeah.
These are different. They're linked to hair follicles, too, but only in specific spots.
Yeah.
The axillae, armpits, the perineum, the areolae of the nipples. Their secretion is thicker, milkier, and interestingly, odorless at first.
Okay. So that classic sweat smell or body odor.
Right.
It's not directly from the apocrine sweat itself.
Correct. It only develops when that thicker apocrine secretion gets broken down by the bacteria that live naturally on our skin.
That explains why deodorants target the armpits so heavily.
Exactly. That's where the apocrine action and the resulting odor potential is concentrated.
All right. That covers the structures and their basic jobs. Now, how do we investigate when things go wrong? This brings us to the subjective side, gathering that comprehensive history.
Yes, and this is where you really put on your detective hat, adopting that examiner mindset. A good history helps you figure out, is this just a local skin thing, or is it a sign of something deeper, something systemic?
So where do you start? History of present concern.
Always. If someone comes in with a rash, you need details. How long has it been there? Where exactly is it? What does it feel like? Itchy, painful, numb, burning. And crucially, what makes it better or worse?
And what if they mention pain or changes in temperature perception or maybe numbness or tingling?
Ding, ding, ding. Those are red flags. Pain or sensation changes often point towards vascular problems like poor circulation or neurological issues. These can severely impact skin health and healing, making it much more serious than just a simple rash.
Got it. Next up, personal health history. Beyond obvious past skin issues, what are we digging for?
Allergies are huge, especially drug allergies, but also environmental ones. They can cause a massive range of skin reactions, from mild hives right up to severe, potentially life-threatening rashes like Stevens-Johnson syndrome.
Okay, and past trauma.
Specifically, we need to ask about any history of severe blistering sunburns, especially in childhood. This is non-negotiable. That history dramatically increases the lifetime risk of skin cancer, particularly melanoma. It needs to be documented clearly.
Good point. What else in personal history?
We also check for prior hospitalizations or stays in long-term care. That automatically puts someone at higher risk for hospital-acquired infections, including being colonized with MRSA, which we'll talk more about later.
Makes sense. then family history. What are the key things there?
Well, you look for contagious things that might be going around the family, chickenpox, measles, maybe scabies, or lice. But more significantly, for long-term risk, you screen for genetic predispositions.
Like skin cancer.
Definitely number one. A family history of skin cancer, especially melanoma, is a major risk factor. But also other conditions like keloids.
Ah, those raised scars.
Exactly. Keloids are these exaggerated scar tissue formations after an injury. There's a strong genetic link, and they're much, much more common in people of African-American, or Asian descent. Knowing that family history provides important context for your physical exam later.
Which flows right into lifestyle and health practices. This is where behavior meets risk. Sun exposure seems obvious.
Critical. We need to ask about sunbathing habits, tanning bed use frequency, duration. How often are they really getting significant UV exposure?
And do they check themselves?
Yes, we need to know. Are they doing regular skin self-exams? Do they know the ABCDE method for looking at moles? We'll cover that in detail. Also, think about occupational or environmental exposures. Are they constantly working with chemicals, hair dyes, cleaning agents?
Or maybe just sitting too much.
Huge factor. Spending long hours sitting or lying in one position, especially with limited mobility, is probably the single biggest risk factor for skin breakdown and pressure injuries.
And the sources mentioned an interesting link between, like, body odor control or sweating and other health issues.
Right. If someone reports sudden difficulty controlling body odor or excessive sweating that's hyperhidrosis, it could potentially be a sign of an underlying endocrine issue, like an overactive thyroid, or sometimes even a neurological condition. Conversely, not sweating enough can mess with the temperature regulation.
Fascinating. And this ties into cultural and biological variations, doesn't it? We know skin color varies based on ancestry and proximity to the equator. Mm-hmm. But what's the big clinical takeaway there?
The really heavy clinical implication is the risk of delayed diagnosis, particularly for skin cancer. Some lesions, especially early melanomas or subtle color changes indicating inflammation, are just harder to see on darker skin tones.
So they might get diagnosed later.
Unfortunately, yes. People with darker skin are statistically more likely to be diagnosed at a later stage, which often means a poorer prognosis. This demands extra vigilance during the exam, really looking closely, using good lighting, and knowing what subtle signs to look for.
And some conditions are just more common in certain groups.
Correct. Things like vitiligo, certain types of psoriasis, those keloids we mentioned, and a condition called dermatitis papulosa nigra. Small, dark bumps, often on the face, are seen more frequently in specific racial or ethnic groups.
And even sweat production varies.
Yeah. The sources note that many individuals of Asian and Native American descent tend to have less active apocrine sweat glands compared to white and African American individuals. This means they might genuinely have less body odor. It's important background for interpreting your assessment findings.
Okay, that background is essential. Now let's get practical. Objective assessment, techniques, and findings. How do we set up for a thorough skin exam?
Preparation is key for a complete look. You really need the client to remove all clothing, jewelry, makeup, nail polish, artificial nails, even wigs or hair pieces if possible. You need good lighting. Daylight is best if you can get it, and a comfortable room temperature. If the room's too cold, vasoconstriction can make the skin look paler or bluish, skewing your assessment.
And the process itself, where do you start?
Be systematic. A common approach is to start with the hands and nails. They're easy to see and can show a lot. Then work your way through the rest of the body, head to toe, being consistent.
What about in a hospital or care facility setting? Is the focus different?
Absolutely. In those settings, your primary focus immediately shifts to skin integrity and pressure ulcer prevention. You are meticulously checking all pressure points, areas under medical devices like casts or IVs, places prone to moisture, and especially within skin folds on larger clients under the breasts, penetooth, and the groin. These areas are prime spots for breakdown.
You mentioned different types of exams earlier, general versus focused.
Right. A general routine screening involves looking at everything, a full integumentary check as part of a complete physical. A focused assessment, though, zeroes in on a specific complaint. If someone says their scalp is incredibly itchy, you'll do a detailed inspection of just the hair and scalp, looking for lice, nits, lesions, scaling, maybe skipping a detailed foot exam for that specific issue.
Okay, now for the really crucial part of the objective exam. Interpreting color changes. These can be instant clues about what's happening systemically. Let's start with pallor.
Pallor means paleness, that loss of the normal underlying red-pink tones. Skin might look pale, whitish, or even ashen. It often signals poor circulation, maybe arterial insufficiency or anemia, not enough hemoglobin carrying oxygen.
How does it look in darker skin?
It's trickier. You won't see that loss of pinkness, obviously. Instead, the skin might take on a dull sort of grayish or sometimes yellowish-brown appearance. The best places to check for pallor in dark-skinned individuals are the mucous membranes inside the mouth, the conjunctivae of the eyes.
Good tip. Next, erythema, redness, and warmth. What causes that?
Erythema is caused by vasodilation, increased blood flow to the area. Think fever, inflammation, trauma like a sunburn, or an allergic reaction. It makes the skin red and often feel warm to the touch.
And the big challenge here, again, is with darker skin tones.
Exactly. Visually detecting redness on darkly pigmented skin can be extremely difficult, sometimes impossible. So the crucial nursing implication is you must rely on palpation. Gently feel the area. Are you detecting localized warmth compared to the surrounding skin? Is there any swelling, edema, or firmness? Those palpable signs, warmth, edema, induration, become your primary indicators of inflammation.
Palpation is key.
Got it.
And there's cyanosis, that bluish tinge. What's that telling us?
Cyanosis signals a lack of oxygen in the blood, but here's a critical distinction you absolutely have to make.
Central versus peripheral.
Precisely. Central cyanosis affects the core body, the trunk, and especially the mucous membranes. Check the lips, the oral mucosa, the tongue. If you see blue there, it suggests a serious systemic problem, usually cardiopulmonary. Think heart failure, respiratory failure, poor oxygen saturation overall.
Okay, that's serious. What about peripheral?
Peripheral cyanosis is localized, usually in the extremities, fingertips, nail beds, sometimes the tip of the nose or earlobes. This is typically due to sluggish or constricted blood flow locally, maybe extreme cold exposure causing vasoconstriction or peripheral vascular disease. Again, in dark skin, cyanosis might make the affected area look dull, dark, maybe almost lifeless rather than distinctly blue. Check nail beds and mucous membranes carefully.
Right, and the last major color change. Jaundice, the yellowing.
Right. Jaundice is usually abnormal, unless we're talking about some physiologic jaundice in newborns. In adults, it's most often linked to liver problems, hepatitis, cirrhosis where bilirubin builds up in the blood. It can also be seen in conditions that cause rapid red blood cell breakdown, like sickle cell disease.
Where's the best place to spot jaundice?
The sclera, the whites of the eyes, are usually the first place it shows up. Also check the oral mucosa, especially under the tongue and the palms and soles. In darker skinned individuals, checking the hard palate in the mouth is often more reliable than the sclera.
Okay, excellent overview of color changes. Now, we can't talk assessment without considering the older adult. Age brings predictable changes that impact what we find and what risks are present.
Definitely. Structurally, things change. Sebum production decreases, leading to that common complaint of dry, itchy skin. Melanin production can also decrease, making the skin look paler, sometimes more translucent, and dermal vascularity reduces too.
And that collagen we talked about in the dermis takes a hit.
Right? Big time. Collagen breaks down, elastin fibers wear out, so the skin loses that snapback quality, that turgor. This leads to sagging, wrinkling, especially face, neck, arms, breasts, scrotum. And functionally, that loss of resilience makes the skin much more fragile, more prone to tearing from friction or shear.
What about hair and nails in older adults?
Hair generally thins, feels coarser, maybe drier. Growth slows down. You often see decreased axillary and pubic hair. And interestingly, many older women notice an increase in coarse terminal hair growth on the chin or upper lip due to hormonal shifts.
And nails?
Nails can become thicker, sometimes yellowish, often brittle and prone to splitting. This can make basic nail care quite challenging, especially foot care.
Do we see specific lesions more often in older adults?
Yes. Several benign lesions become much more common. Things like seborrheic keratosis and senile keratosis, those crusty, warty-looking spots. Senile lentigines, which most people call liver spots or age spots. Cheriangiomas, those little bright red dots. And cutaneous tags or skin tags. They're all generally harmless but common findings.
So what's the big picture clinical takeaway for assessing older adults?
It's the convergence of these changes.
Yeah.
Decreased mobility, maybe some sensory decline, combined with more fragile, drier skin, significantly increases their risk for hygiene challenges and, most importantly, for developing pressure injuries. Their skin just doesn't tolerate pressure or friction as well.
That leads us perfectly into our first major clinical focus area, major skin integrity threats. Let's start with the big one, skin cancer. Talk us through the pathophysiology and prevention.
Okay. Skin cancer is, hands down, the most common type of cancer overall. And the vast majority is linked to cumulative damage from ultraviolet or UV radiation. The sources highlight three main types we need to know.
Let's start with the most frequent, basal cell carcinoma or BCC.
Right. BCC makes up the lion's share of skin cancers and is generally the least risky in terms of metastasis. It comes from the basal cells deep in the epidermis. Clinically, it often looks like a small, painless, raised bump. It might be shiny, pearly, sometimes with tiny visible blood vessels, telangiectasias running across it. Or it might form a little central ulceration that doesn't quite heal. Cure rates are very high with early treatment.
Okay. Second type, squamous cell carcinoma, SCC.
SCC arises from the squamous cells higher up in the epidermis. This one is strongly linked to chronic, prolonged UV exposure, think years of sun damage or tanning vid use. It often appears as a firm red nodule, a scaly flat lesion, or an ulcer that fails to heal. There's a specific type called Bowen disease, which looks like a persistent, scaly, thickened patch. SCC has a higher potential to spread than BCC, so early detection is more critical.
And then the most feared type, melanoma.
Yes, melanoma is the most serious because it can metastasize, spread to other organs much more readily and rapidly. It originates from the melanocytes, the pigment-producing cells. The classic sign is a change in an existing mole or the appearance of a new, unusual-looking pigmented spot or growth. It's strongly associated with intense intermittent sun exposure, those blistering sunburns we talked about, and also tanning bed use.
We really need to hammer home the risk factors. It's not just sun, is it?
No, it's a combination. Major risks include high lifetime sun exposure, any use of tanning beds, non-solar UVR, having fair skin that burns easily, freckles, light hair eyes, a family history of skin cancer, especially melanoma, having numerous moles or specific atypical moles, older age, and being male, statistically higher rates.
Any other factor?
Yes, also exposure to certain chemicals, having HPV, areas of chronic inflammation or old scars, smoking and alcohol use have links. And interestingly, the sources point to inadequate intake of niacin, which is vitamin B3.
That niacin connection is interesting. Why would vitamin B3 help protect against skin cancer?
Well, niacin, particularly in the form of nicotinamide, is essential for cellular energy production and crucially for DNA repair mechanisms. The theory is that UV radiation constantly damages skin cell DNA. Adequate niacin helps provide the resources those cells need to repair that damage effectively. If you're deficient, the repair process might be less efficient, allowing those UV-induced mutations to accumulate and potentially lead to cancer.
So it helps the skin's natural defense and repair systems. Makes sense.
Mm.
This brings us to the crucial education piece. The ABCDE mnemonic for checking lesions.
Every single person should know this. It's a simple checklist for evaluating moles or suspicious spots. A is for asymmetry. If you draw a line through the middle, the two halves don't match. Healthy moles are usually symmetrical.
Okay.
B is for border. Are the edges irregular, notched, scalloped, blurred, or poorly defined? Melanomas often have uneven borders. Okay. C is for color. Is the color uneven? Does it have multiple shades of brown, black, tan, sometimes even red, white, or blue? Variation or change in color is a warning sign.
D.
D is for diameter. Is the lesion larger than 6 millimeters across? That's about the size of a pencil erasure. Although, importantly, melanomas can start smaller.
Andy.
E is for evolving. Has the mole or spot changed in any way over weeks or months? Change in size, shape, color, elevation, or new symptoms like bleeding, itching, or crusting? Any change needs checking.
ABCDE. Simple, memorable, potentially life-saving. Prevention is key too. Less exposure, sunscreen, protective clothes, and maybe keeping an eye on that B3 intake.
Exactly. Now, let's shift gears to another major threat, especially in healthcare settings. MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus.
The superbug. Resistant to many antibiotics. Right?
Precisely. That resistance makes it tough to treat. And we need to think about where it's acquired. Hospital-acquired HAI versus community-acquired CAI, because the risk factors differ.
Okay. What puts someone at risk for HAI-MRSA?
Think about the hospital environment. Having an invasive medical device like a central line, urinary catheter, or ventilator, residing in a long-term care facility, having recent surgery, or simply being in close proximity to someone else known to have MRSA.
So exposure within the healthcare system. What about CAI-MRSA out in the community?
The risks there are more about close contact and lifestyle. Playing contact sports where you get skin abrasions, sharing personal items, towels, razors, athletic equipment, having a weakened immune system, living in crowded or unsanitary conditions, working in healthcare, recent antibiotic use, interestingly, within the last 3 to 6 months, being very young or very old, hemodialysis patients, And men who have sex with men are also identified as a higher risk group.
Lots of factors.
Yeah.
How do facilities manage MRSA risk?
It's often about a bundled approach, the MRSA bundle. This usually includes screening high-risk patients on admission, often with a nasal swab, to see if they're colonized, using strict contact precautions for anyone known to be positive gown, glove, obsessive attention to hand hygiene for everyone, and really fostering a strong institutional culture of infection control.
And what should we tell patients to prevent spreading it?
Keep any wounds clean and covered. Don't share personal items like towels or razors. Wash hands frequently. Clean sports gear regularly. Wash clothing and bedding thoroughly, especially if someone in the household has an infection.
Good practical advice. Okay, our third major integrity threat and a huge challenge in patient care, pressure injuries, sometimes still called pressure ulcers or bed sores.
Yes, these are localized damage to the skin and the underlying tissue. They usually happen over a bony prominence, heels, sacrum, hips, elbows, due to intense or prolonged pressure, or pressure combined with shear forces.
What are the main things that put someone at risk? It seems like multiple factors often combine.
They absolutely do. Key risk factors include, obviously, that prolonged pressure itself. Decreased sensation or perception if you can't feel the discomfort, you don't shift your weight. Decreased mobility if you can't move yourself easily. Excess moisture, maybe from incontinence or heavy sweating, which weakens the skin. Poor nutrition, especially low protein, because protein is vital for tissue building and repair. Friction rubbing against surfaces and sheer sliding down in bed where layers of tissue slide over each other, and having fragile tissues due to age, conditions like diabetes, or poor circulation.
So how do we systematically assess this risk and track healing?
We use standardized tools. The Braden scale is widely used for predicting risk. It scores patients on 6 factors: sensory perception, moisture, activity, mobility, nutrition, and friction shear. A lower score means higher risk.
And if an injury does develop?
Then we often use the PSH tool that stands for Pressure Ulcer Scale for Healing. It helps us objectively track whether the wound is getting better or worse by measuring its size, the amount of exudate drainage, and the type of tissue present in the wound bed.
Okay, understanding the pressure injury staging is absolutely fundamental. Can you walk us through the stages, focusing on what's happening underneath?
Definitely. Stage one is that early warning sign. The skin is still intact, no breaks, but you see persistent redness, non-blanchable erythema. That means if you press on the red area, it doesn't turn white briefly. The redness stays. This indicates some underlying capillary damage.
How might stage one look on darker skin?
It won't look distinctly red. It might appear purplish, maroon, or maybe just a darker shade than the surrounding skin. Palpation is key here, too. The area might feel warmer, cooler, firmer, or softer boggy than the adjacent tissue. It might also be tender.
Okay. Moving to stage two, now we have actual skin loss.
Yes. Stage two is partial thickness skin loss. This means the epidermis is gone and the dermis is exposed. The wound bed looks pink or red. It's moist. Importantly, in stage two, you do not see any granulation tissue, that beefy red healing tissue, slow yellowish dead tissue, or Escher, black leathery dead tissue.
And it looked like anything else.
Yes. And this is a key point. A stage two injury can also present as an intact or ruptured serum-filled blister. Seeing that blister over a pressure area often means stage two damage underneath.
Got it. Blister off in stage two. Now, stage three, we're going deeper.
Much deeper. Stage three is full thickness skin loss. Now, the damage extends through the dermis, and you can actually see the subcutaneous adipose tissue fat in the wound bed. You will often see granulation tissue here, possibly some slough or Escher. The wound edges might start to look rolled. That's called epibole, and it hinders healing. Undermining tissue loss under the edge, or tunneling, a channel extending from the wound, might also be present.
So fat is visible. What about stage four?
Stage four is full thickness skin and tissue loss. The damage is so extensive that you have exposed or directly palpable deeper structures. We're talking fascia, muscle, tendon, ligament, cartilage, or even bone. Slough and Escher are commonly present. Undermining and tunneling are often extensive. These are devastating injuries.
And there's one more category, unstageable. What does that mean?
An injury is labeled unstageable if it's clearly full thickness tissue loss, so at least a stage three or four, but you can't actually see the base of the wound to determine the true depth. Why? Because it's obscured, covered by too much slough or Escher.
So you have to clean it out first.
Exactly. That necrotic tissue needs to be debrided, removed, before you can accurately stage the injury as either a three or a four.
Okay, the staging is crackle clear. Given how bad these can get, what's the core strategy for prevention and management?
It boils down to minimizing pressure, friction, shear, and moisture. That means meticulous, regular skin inspection, at least daily. using a risk assessment tool like the Breedon scale routinely. Careful bathing, use mild soap, lukewarm water, not hot. Pat dry gently, don't rub vigorously. Moisturize dry skin.
What about positioning?
Absolutely critical. Frequent repositioning for those with limited mobility. Using proper lifting techniques or devices to avoid dragging and shear forces. Pay attention to managing incontinence promptly. And this is important, avoid vigorously massaging bony prominences. While gentle massage might feel good, deep massage over a pressure point can actually damage underlying capillaries and tissues. And refer early for nutritional support or complex wound care needs.
All right. Protect, inspect, reposition, manage moisture and nutrition. Okay, that covers the major threats. For our final clinical focus, let's think about the skin as a sort of reference library decoding the huge variety of lesions and disorders we might see. How do we even start categorizing them?
We usually start by distinguishing between primary skin lesions, the initial lesion that appears spontaneously as the first sign, and secondary skin lesions, which result from changes to a primary lesion over time, maybe from scratching or infection.
Okay, let's tackle primary lesions first. How about the flat ones you can't feel?
Those are macules and patches. A macule is flat, colored less than 1 centimeter. Think freckles, petechiae, flat moles. A patch is the same flat, colored but larger than 1 centimeter. Examples include large birthmarks or areas of vitiligo.
Okay, flat down. What about raised solid bumps?
We have several. A small, solid, raised lesion less than 1 centimeter is a papule. Warts or elevated moles are good examples. If it's larger than 1 centimeter and flat-topped, like a plateau, that's a plaque classic in psoriasis or actinic keratosis.
And deeper solid lesions.
If the solid mass extends deeper into the dermis and it's about 1 to 2 centimeters, we call it a nodule. Think keloids or lipomas, fatty tumors. If it's larger than 2 centimeters, it's generally called a tumor, which could be benign or malignant, like a carcinoma.
Got it. Now for the fluid-filled ones, these often indicate infection or burns.
Right. A small, raised lesion filled with clear, serious fluid less than 1 centimeters is a vesicle. Think herpes blisters, poison ivy, chickenpox, early second-degree burns. If it's larger than 1 centimeter and filled with fluid, it's a bulla, like large burn blisters or the blisters seen in bullous impetigo.
What if it's filled with pus?
Then it's a pustule, basically a vesicle or bulla containing purulent fluid. Acne pimples or pustular impetigo are examples.
Are there other primary types?
Yes. A couple more key ones. A wheal is a raised, often reddish or pale, temporary lesion caused by fluid leaking into the dermis. It typically has transient, irregular borders. The classic example is hives, urticaria, or an insect bite reaction. And a cyst is an encapsulated sac filled with fluid or semi-solid material located in the dermis or subcutaneous layer.
Okay, those are the original lesions. What happens when they change? That brings us to secondary skin lesions.
Exactly. These result from evolution or trauma to primary lesions. For instance, an erosion is a superficial loss of the epidermis. It's moist but doesn't bleed or expand into the dermis, like when a blister roof comes off or a canker sore.
Deeper than an erosion.
That's an ulcer. This involves loss of the epidermis and at least part of the dermis. Ulcers often bleed and can involve necrotic tissue loss. Pressure injuries are a type of ulcer.
What about after healing?
That leaves a scar or cicatrix, the fibrous connective tissue that replaces normal tissue after injury. And a fissure is a linear crack or break in the skin that extends down into the dermis. Often painful, common with severe dryness like on heels or in athlete's foot between the toes.
Okay, secondary lesions covered. Next big category, vascular skin lesions. These are blood vessel related and can tell us a lot about circulation or bleeding issues.
Definitely. First, distinguish petechiae from ecchymosis. Petechiae are tiny, pinpoint, round, red, or purple spots, usually 1 to 2 millimeter. They're caused by minor bleeding from capillaries under the skin. Seeing these can be a sign of low platelets, thrombocytopenia, or other bleeding tendencies. They don't blanch when pressed.
And ecchymosis is just a bruise.
Basically, yes. Ecchymosis is a larger, irregular area of purple or bluish discoloration resulting from blood leaking out of vessels into the tissue, usually due to trauma. It does change color over time as the blood breaks down purple-blue to greenish to yellow.
What about a raised bruise?
That's likely a hematoma. It's a localized collection of blood, often clotted, that creates a raised, palpable mass under the skin, also usually from trauma.
Okay. Then we have the angiomas. What's a cherry angioma?
These are very common, especially with age. They're small, 1 to 5 millimeter, round, bright red or purplish, slightly raised papules, usually on the trunk. They're benign clusters of capillaries and generally not concerning unless they change or bleed frequently.
But the spider angioma is more concerning.
It can be. A spider angioma has a central red arteriole, like a spider's body, with fine reddish vessels radiating outwards like legs. They blanch with pressure on the central body. While a few can be normal, numerous or large ones are strongly associated with liver disease, like cirrhosis, because the liver isn't breaking down estrogen properly. They can also appear in pregnancy or sometimes with severe vitamin B deficiency.
Good to know. And telangiectasis.
Also called a Venus star sometimes. This is a bluish or reddish lesion, often looking like a starburst or linear pattern. It's caused by dilation of small veins or capillaries near the surface, often seen on the legs or chest, frequently related to increased venous pressure, like in varicose veins.
Okay, lesion types too. But how they're arranged matters too, right? The configurations of lesions.
Absolutely. The pattern often helps clinch the diagnosis. Linear means lesions appear in a straight line. Think of a scratch, or sometimes poison ivy if you brushed against the plant stem.
Circular.
That's annular, meaning ring-shaped, often with central clearing. Tinea corporis, or ringworm, is the classic example.
What if they're grouped together?
That's clustered. Like, the vesicles of herpes simplex often appear in a tight group.
And if they're separate or merged?
Discrete lesions are individual and separate, not touching. Like, multiple moles scattered across the back. If they're merged or running together to form a larger patch, that's confluent. Tinea versicolor often looks confluent. And nummular means coin-shaped, roundish patches, often seen in nummular eczema.
Linear, annular, clustered, discrete, confluent, nummular. Got it.
Okay.
Last stop on our reference tour, the nails. Like skin, they can show signs of systemic problems. What are some common nail disorders to watch for?
Several key ones. Pitting, which looks like tiny little depressions or pits in the nail plate, is strongly associated with psoriasis. It can also be seen in other autoimmune conditions.
What about shape changes?
Coelenichia, or spoon nails, is where the nails become concave, curving upwards like a spoon. This is classically linked to iron deficiency anemia, but can also relate to thyroid issues or heart disease.
Color changes.
Yellow nail syndrome is characterized by nails that grow very slowly, become thickened, and turn yellowish or yellow-green. It's often associated with chronic respiratory problems like chronic bronchitis, lymphedema, or sometimes immunodeficiency like AIDS.
An infection around the nail.
That's paronychia. It's a common inflammation or infection of the skin fold around the nail base, usually bacterial or fungal. Causes redness, swelling, pain, sometimes pus.
Ooh, okay, that was incredibly thorough. We've gone from the basic structure through assessment, major threats like cancer and pressure injuries, right down to decoding specific lesions and nail changes. If you're using this deep dive as a study guide, that's a really dense pack of high-yield information.
It is. And if I had to pull out the absolute must-know clinical takeaways, master differentiating central versus peripheral cyanosis, it tells you completely different things. Commit those pressure injury stages to memory, focusing on what tissue is visible. Intact skin but non-blanchable red, stage 1, exposed dermis or blister, stage 2, visible fat, stage 3, exposed bone, muscle, tendon, stage 4. And please teach yourself and everyone you know the ABCDEs for melanoma detection. Early catch is everything.
Absolutely critical points. So, for a final thought, we talked about skin being part of our identity, but it's more than that, isn't it? It's like a living document, a biological record of our lives. When you do that thorough assessment, you're reading a story.
You really are. You see the genetic hand you were dealt, maybe a predisposition to keloids or fair skin prone to burning. You see the environmental tally, the sun damage accumulated over years. You see clues about cultural practices, maybe hygiene habits or sun exposure norms. And you definitely see the results of lifestyle choices and overall health nutrition status reflected in healing, pressure injuries from immobility. It's all written there.
It truly is a narrative, from the smallest freckle to a major scar or lesion. So maybe the final thought for you, the listener, is this. Your skin tells your story. As you learn to read it in others, take a moment to consider what does your skin assessment reveal about your own health history and the choices shaping your narrative.